You've probably heard Jim Gammon's crusty growl in any number of movies like Silverado and Wild Bill, and Lois Smith can be seen these days everywhere from Twister to Dead Man Walking. But you have the chance of a lifetime right now to catch these two amazing actors live on stage at the Brooks Atkinson in Sam Shepard's Pulitzer Prize winning play, Buried Child. I'm very pleased to have them both here on New York & Company now. Hi.
Hi.
I didn't quite know what to expect in this interview, whether the both of you would spend the whole time yelling because you scream an awful lot in Buried Child. Oh,
we don't do that in the afternoon. We only do that at night.
At night, right.
Pretty much the whole first act is spent in conversation, if I can call it that, between the two of you, where you're not even in the same room and you're just screaming toward each other. I wondered about the timing of all of that, because you're not within eyesight of each other. Are there problems sometimes if you can't see the other person?
It's certainly a very different thing than if you a very different way to play a scene. I, who am off stage, have a video monitor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I can't hear Jim and the audience very well without it. It's not soundproof back there, but it's too far from. So
you're playing to a
TV
screen.
So our timing is yes, in a way. I'm playing a radio show for the first 20 pages or something, and then I come on and play a stage play. It really does feel that way part of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a part of the play that people remark on a great deal and like a great deal, so I've stopped worrying about it, though I must say I worried about it a lot before we started rehearsal and even after.
Well, also just the fear that you're going to have to be shouting so much, you must worry about laryngitis.
Yes,
and
it's taken a toll. It really has.
And I'd wondered what your actual voice would be like, James, because you have this growl that the first thing that occurred to me was, how does he project to the back of the theater with that raspy voice and yet everyone hears you?
Well, I don't know. We do have mics there, you know, when things go. Sometimes, you know, in the beginning of the week, it's a lot easier. We've had a little rest. We've had a day off, so it's easier to project. But when it gets later in the week, as a general rule,
mm-hmm.
I think Vic Vetusis, who's our sound operator, has to crank that mic a little bit for me for some moments. I don't like that, really, but it seems to be a necessity, and
and it's happening more and more in theater.
And it's happening more and more in theater, that's true.
Well, at least it's coming from where we are. We're not. It's not that sort of generalized mic sound, which you don't know where it is.
Well, you see in the musicals now, where you have no feeling that you're actually seeing these live. The whole idea of going to theater is to see these live people talk where they are.
Mm-hmm.
In your case, Jim, you're handicapped also by the fact that you spend most of the time immobile under a ratty blanket. But one critic noted, for someone who's motionless, you seem to be everywhere on the stage.
Yeah. Well, it's arduous, and that's for sure. My performance basically is a vocal performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think I only get off the couch really one time for any movement, and that's in the second act.
Mm-hmm.
And I crawl a little bit, but outside of that, it's rather stationary performance.
And is that a handicap for an actor who's used to being able to move all over the stage? Because actors really do rely an awful lot on how they move their shoulders, tilt their heads.
I think it is a liability in that sense, because you can draw. The body moving can help you get some air sometimes. I'll notice that at times, to obtain certain moments,
mm-hmm.
I'll have to put my hand down on to my stomach to literally push more air out. So rather than just it coming from, you know, up higher in the throat, I run out of air, and it seems like, so to get the extra air, and I had to put the pressure on my stomach.
That's
area.
Not something they teach you in acting school, is it?
No, it isn't. This is a This play here is, I think, a class in survival.
Also, this is dialogue that is, it can't be the easiest to perform.
Oh, maybe not the easiest, but it's like living inside a wonderful poem or a piece of music. Mm-hmm. So in a way, once one has it, I wouldn't say easy, but it has the ease of the real thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, that you play a long married couple, Dodge and Haley, who seem to have been having had, they seem to have had the same conversation for most of their lives. They don't really hear each other. Actually, they speak more in monologues. I'm not even sure that it is conversation at times, because talk here is used more to conceal, I think, than to reveal. But that's something that you have to get across in very subtle ways.
It's the most familiar thing in the world, it seems to me. It's one of the wonders of this play, which I never feel I've plummeted to the bottom of, how he made these people and who they are and what they do mm-hmm. so fantastically familiar to such a wide range of people. And somehow he did that. And
as absurd as they are in some ways.
Yeah.
Because
there,
these are
there
wild
is something
characters.
About this conversation which we all recognize, even though it's... As you say, it's full of concealment and avoidance. And
pretty much the same sort of thing that O'Neill wrote about with troubled families as well, and yet there is great difference between the way Sam Shepard writes the troubled family and from the right. way that O'Neill writes the family. Do you think about those things when you're preparing for these kinds of characters? Do you compare them to other characters you've played?
No, I don't really. Myself, I just... sail in, and Sam's writing is such that the music kind of carries you, you know, in his writing. And the Gary Sinise,
who directed this,
powerful director, is unrelenting as a director, very brilliant as a director, but will take every ounce of everything you have to get what he needs, and I don't mind that. It's just it's he's such a dynamic director, and I seldom have worked with a director who requires as much as Gary.
Mm-hmm. Most people will know him as one of the main characters in Forrest Gump, but he also, mm-hmm. in fact, he appeared with you, Lois, in Grapes of Wrath some years ago,
yes.
in that Steppenwolf production. Did he direct that as well?
No, Frank Galati directed. Gary played Tom Joad, and I played Ma Joad, his mother in that.
So he's just started directing?
Oh, no. He founded with Terry Kinney and Jeff Perry the Steppenwolf Company 20 years ago.
John Malkovich was also involved.
He was one of the early members, yes. And Gary and the rest of them have been directing and acting in that company for all this time.
And you, Mr. Gammon, you've been in four Sam Shepard plays before this, so you must feel like you really know him. It's almost like Jason Robards in O'Neill plays.
I'm not so sure. I love Sam's work, and I guess I have an affinity for his work. I worked with Gary back, I think, 15 years ago on Curse of the Starving Class in Los Angeles. He played my son, Wesley, mm-hmm. played Weston. I thought at that time that was his greatest play until, of course, we worked on this one. But I don't know that I answered your question.
No, you did fine. The both of you were in the Steppenwolf production in Chicago as well. Pretty much the same cast?
All but two people, yes.
Mm-hmm. Does it change a lot when you go from city to city? The different kind of theater, the different kinds of audiences?
It's more the same than different, but the changes are great as well. Certainly having two, it's a small cast of seven people, so having two people different was very different, very exciting both times, and very different, I think, that those performances.
Sometimes it's just a matter of how fast people deliver their lines? Or
it's more than that. This play is so deep that each character's comes out of not only Jim's absolutely right, the dynamics of Gary's direction are extremely strong and extremely taxing, but once you're there, you're living in that world at that at that intensity, there is then a lot of room, both in Sam's writing and in Gary's work, for the actor.
But does it help to have worked together before? You were both in a movie, weren't you, in an HBO production of Truman? Does it feel better if you've had some previous interaction when you get into a production like this?
We were both in Truman, but yeah. We had nothing to do with each other. Our characters didn't cross, definitely.
That's the great thing about movie making. You can be in the same film and never see each other.
Never see the person, right. No. Yeah. But yes, it matters hugely to have an acquaintance with your fellows, and we have a lot of that in this company.
Well, Sam Shepard is also an actor. Did he talk to you about this, or does he keep hands off when somebody else is directing one of his plays?
Pretty much hands off.
Mm-hmm. The second time through, he talked to us a bit more. He and Gary were sort of there all the time in the New York rehearsals, and both and the stricture was lifted a little. Don't you think, Jim, about Sam filtering entirely through Gary? I think everybody was a little looser.
Sam did participated more in this, I think, than I would say in other plays where he hasn't been the director. Mm-hmm. And I would say that's true.
Interestingly, this is the first production of a Sam Shepard play ever on Broadway, and mm-hmm. it comes by way of Chicago.
Right.
With that in mind, with him understanding the dynamics of all of that, because this is really important in theater, isn't it? That a director be the director and not seem to be undermined by anybody else. That might be more important for, let's say, a young actor. But you people are all pros. Do you ultimately care who is telling you what to do, as long as you come up with the best performance you can?
I take the director's choices all the time. Mm-hmm. As the first choice.
And it's very important to have the a strong and clear director, if he's any good, and we were very lucky that he was quite good.
Did Shepard change the play at all since 1979, or is this pretty much what was performed then?
It's changed. Well, how many, Lois? 501 lines.
I don't know the number, but
they counted and advertised 501 lines, something like that. It's kind of. I think they wanted to infuse some comedy into this horrible tragedy.
Mm. And you get to say most of the funny lines.
Oh well, I guess I have a few.
Well, one that I remember, because this is really a play about people who have a great need to connect with family but really don't seem to. Your line that I remember is, you think just because people propagate, they have to love their offspring. when you're delivering a line like that, which you know is going to get a laugh, do you have to hold back so that you don't kind of prompt the laugh?
Well, I simply try and relate to the other character, basically. And if a laugh occurs, why, we suspend for a bit and then continue on. But it's in this, with the same attitude and the same intensity.
Because it's different when you're doing a laugh line in a comedy, which is supposed to get a lot of laughs, and getting laughs in a drama where the time is almost supposed to be real time.
I don't know that it's different. It's basically true in both cases. I mean, ideally. And then there is the pause while the laugh happens.
You have an odd situation in this play because you're in the first act, then you're not in the second act, you reappear in the third act, and with a totally different look. You leave in the first act when we finally see you after all the shouting from another room. You're in black with your white hair flowing, and then when you come back, you're in a yellow dress, and your hair has been dyed.
That's right.
why the hair dye? What do you think the significance of?
Go ahead, Lon.
There's so many kinds of significance that I think the great fun is for me, but for the people seeing the play is making of it. Mm-hmm. What there is to make of it, and there's plenty to make of it.
But that's a directorial decision, isn't it?
The red hair is. Sam's very specific about the yellow dress, the white gloves. Mm-hmm. But I think the red hair was a brilliant.
Yeah, it was sure startles the audience. Yeah. We'll take a little break here and come back with more from James Gammon, who plays Dodge, and Lois Smith, who plays Haley, in the production of Sam Shepard's Pulitzer Prize-winning play, Buried Child, which is at the Brooks Atkinson Theater. The both of you have had careers in film and in theater, but very different kinds, right? Lois Smith, you started in the way that almost modern theater started, in biblical plays.
When I was a little girl and a child, yes, in churches, when my father used to direct plays in the church. That is my first acting, absolutely.
And did you know even then that it would always be?
Oh, no. I mean, I'm sure that's what started it, because it was at a very tender age. But I just proceeded and, acted in school and then acted in high school and was a drama major in high school, which was sort of unusual, happened to be a school where they had a drama major. Uh-huh. Then I went to college at the University of Washington, which had a notable drama department, and I went there as a drama major, and then I just continued. I mean,
you came to New York only because your husband moved to New York.
No, I came to New York to be an actor, and he came east to go into graduate school at Harvard about the same time.
And then the movies. Your first film was East of Eden.
Right. Yes.
Impressive start.
Yes.
Then you were in Five Easy Pieces. In fact, just think, you played opposite James Dean, and then you played opposite Jack Nicholson.
Yes.
Played Jack Nicholson's girlfriend.
Sister.
Sister, right, in Five Easy Pieces.
Right.
And a lot of films ever since. In fact, you could pretty much chart your life by looking at the films that you've been in over the years.
I don't know about that. I mean, there are quite a few of them by now, though. It's, not a...
Well, there's been Fried Green Tomatoes, How to Make an American Quilt just recently, Dead Man Walking.
Oh, yes, I had a little spree just recently. There were lots of films in the last couple of years, and those you've mentioned. And then
coming up, Larger Than Life with Bill Murray.
Right. That's the opening next month, I think, and Twister's running right now.
And James, you were mostly in theater. The film is pretty late in your development. No?
Well, I really got into theater in Los Angeles, and I think my own theater in 73. Mm-hmm. And that company still is existing in L.A. now. It's called the Met. But I'd done theater before in high school and grade school, and kind of always gravitated to the theater world. And I couldn't tell you really why. I suppose because you get an immediate reaction from someone because of something you did. And it kind of sticks with you. And
well, in your case, you were living in L.A. and doing mostly theater. Lois was living in New York and doing a lot of movies at the same time.
I was doing mostly theater. I think the films were interspersed, but I always lived in New York, and it's hard to say. You know, one year it'll be more one than another.
I'm always interested in how actors feel about the two. For example, someone like Catherine Deneuve, who never has been in a theater production, says she's deadly afraid of going on the stage, but is quite comfortable in front of a camera. Most actors, I think, say they prefer theater, but not everyone. Are they both fun for you?
Well, I think, they're different entirely. Yeah. They're different mediums. If you could make the money to exist in life doing theater, I suppose I would like to do theater all the time.
So film really is what subsidizes your love for theater?
Has mine.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah.
Even though you've been in some pretty good films, both of you.
Mm-hmm. Take the profits there and roll them back into theater. Mm-hmm.
You've been, James, you've been in a lot of Westerns. I guess you've been typecast. People see you
as... I suppose so.
have you ever thought about that? Why?
Well, I don't know I suppose it's crossed my mind. You know, well, I put off that aura. Mm-hmm. You know, the
you look just not in this Hawaiian shirt that you're wearing. You don't look like some guy.
No, I don't. You don't necessarily feel that way either. However, I do have a great feelings for the Western, and the character in Simpatico that was mm-hmm. that we played a year or so ago at the Public Theater. Why the that character certainly was not, I would say, Western.
Mm-hmm. You know. But in some of the movies, like you've also been Wild Bill, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have the list here somewhere. So Silverado.
Yes.
In fact, there haven't been that many Westerns made in recent years. Yeah. You've been in most of them.
I've had so much reaction from that one little scene in Silverado years ago. People have memorized it, and so I hear it a lot from, you know, people sneaking up behind me and saying the lines in my ear at strange places. You know, like I was watching some horses work at a track one morning, and 6:37 o'clock, and there was this voice behind me said, "So you took the bank in Turley, where's the money?" I turned around, and there was this guy from, this cowboy from Pomona out there that memorized my lines.
Lois, I know you're an Actor's Studio member. Do you have any school that you come out of, James?
Well, Lawrence Park Company of Actors in Los Angeles. I felt fortunate to be involved with Larry. He was very intelligent, very good theater person, very strict.
Mm-hmm.
And
is that Stanislavski based as well?
Well, he worked with Lee Strasberg in New York, and his teaching was based on Stanislavski, Richard Boleslavski. You know, so mm-hmm. that.
In the end, does it really matter? I know a number of actors have told me, I don't care what the school is, as long as you come up with the appropriate performance. Do you think of that?
Sure, except that when you're working with people, it can be a common kind of vocabulary of understanding, mm-hmm. if you've got similar backgrounds in method. But yes, basically, it's always the personal connection as well as any technical connection and the thing itself and, as you say, what you come up with.
You have a very personal way of preparing for a performance, don't you?
A very personal way?
Well, you sleep, don't you? Sleep. do most actors do that?
I don't know.
Take a nap before they go on?
I like to sleep because it's a sort of clearing of it's. Not only am I rested, but it sort of clears the mind and lets it into the deeper places. But
I'd be afraid I'd be groggy.
Oh.
So you're more in touch with your subconscious in a way.
I don't know. Maybe I said that once or twice, and it's people remember it. I don't know. It strikes me as funny as sleep being my preparation for acting. But I guess it's as good an answer as any.
James, you take a nap as well?
The only nap that I have taken in my entire life that I recall, and this was about a week ago on stage, in this play. I fell asleep on stage in the second act. And for the life of me, that's never happened in my life.
Oh, boy.
There's a part where she pokes me on the head. And I didn't feel the first poke, the second poke I felt. And I did come alive quickly.
You're supposed to sleep in at certain points in the play. So
I was supposed to be asleep. But, of course, you know, I never go to sleep. Yeah. And it was rather terrifying to realize that I had been asleep.
Well, you must have really been relaxed. You passed the point where the butterflies affect you before you go on?
Oh, yes. Matter of fact, that's the closest thing to my home is that couch.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. Mm. It really is.
This is a play where a lot of things are unanswered. They are meant to be mysterious. There are hints. There are rumors of incest and, well, more than we have infanticide discussed and the like. Do you have to make sense of things that the audience can't necessarily make sense of in preparing for a role?
Oh, sure. It
has to be,
what
has
I meant
to be
by
more
the,
to you
there
than
is it. There is lots of room for in Sam's play. I mean, it's very specific, but there are also, as you say, not only great mysteries, but also lesser mysteries where there are simply no information about certain off stage.
So do you fill in the information for yourself?
Yes. Mm-hmm. But so does the audience, I think. That's part of the fun and part of the experience. There's room for each of us in this play.
And how long before you become you settle into the part that I see? Is it constantly changing, or is it pretty much set by the time the rehearsals are over?
Well, the blocking's set for sure, but I don't think that we approach. I don't think we approach the play with the idea that we're going to repeat our performances at all. I think we start, and then as an ensemble, we play.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, then there are those things that nobody can predict, like you're falling asleep.
No, please, I wish I hadn't even brought that up.
No, but this happens to actors a lot. I was speaking to somebody about a different performance altogether, and in one of the scenes, this woman reached into her pocket to pull something out, and she pulled out the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it really messed up the whole coherence of the play. He was supposed to light some candles, and the matches wouldn't light, and you know there was 3 minutes of near panic for him.
Yeah.
You know, somebody else. He told me another time that the same woman reached into her pocket for this piece of paper, and it wasn't there. And she said, "Oops, I left it outside," and had to run out. Meanwhile, he was stuck with 3 or 4 minutes of being on the stage alone. I'm sure all of you have had these experiences.
Oh, certainly, there are. It's live theater, and there are events. Last night, I knocked over a lamp when I wasn't supposed to. But it didn't stop anything.
Yeah.
I mean, you know.
And you have to make it look like it really
life
you intended
proceeds.
It, right?
Well, no. The lamp knocked over. It's a real event. It didn't stop anything. It's just happened. But this play is a great play to live with, I think, in the subject of what you're just asking about. It leads one on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Well, James, you've directed. And I wonder whether, when you're performing, whether you step out of your own character once in a while and think about directing yourself, or is it just
no,
the process of...
No, I never, ever consider that idea.
Mm-hmm.
I rely totally on the director, and I consider myself an instrument, really, to be honest with you, and my greatest desire is to perform what the director has asked me to perform, and... when I come close to doing that, I feel rewarded.
In this case, you have more than a chance to eat up the scenery. You get a chance to tear up the scenery.
Yes.
One final question. You must go through an awful lot of ears of corn. There's a lot of corn shucking in this play. What happens to the corn after a performance? Well, do you all wind up eating
corn? I took a lot of it home in Chicago, but actually I haven't been taking... You know, I don't think I see it in the same... where is it? I guess
like that was corn in season there.
That's true. It was corn in season. That's right.
25 ears of corn every
year. A lot of corn. There's a lot of corn in this play.
Yeah, you don't know where it goes.
I don't know anything about the corn. I don't know anything about the carrots nor the peas.
And much of the other mysteries are for the rest of us to figure out. I thank you very much for being on our show today. My guests have been James Gammon and Lois Smith, two of the stars and major stars of the Steppenwolf production of Sam Shepard's Pulitzer Prize winning play Buried Child, which is at the Brooks Atkinson Theater at 256 West 47th Street. You're both amazing. Thank you so much for being on our show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.